This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, how social media is wrecking our brains and what to do about it. The social media grounds are shifting. Just in the past few weeks, Meta, the company that owns Facebook and Instagram, announced it's abandoning third-party fact checks and loosening restrictions around topics like gender and immigration. TikTok got banned, went dark, and came back when President Trump signed an executive order delaying the ban, so the future of that platform remains unclear. And Elon Musk, the owner of X, is now a serious power broker in the new Trump administration. This is all happening at a time when the alarm bells from politicians, doctors, and researchers about social media's harms are louder than ever. For many people, it feels like social media is broken. But technology writer Nicholas Carr argues we need to change the way we're thinking about the problem.
The system is not broken. The system is operating exactly as it is meant to operate.
Nick has been writing about the human consequences of technology for decades. In 2008, he came out with an Atlantic article that eventually became a book, a Pulitzer Prize finalist, The Shallows: What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. It was an early warning of how the internet affects our thoughts and perceptions. Now he's out with a new book all about social media and its impact on society. It's called Superbloom: How Technologies of Connection Tear Us Apart. So I sat down with Nick to talk about how we got here and what might come next.
I think when we look at the problems, we tend to immediately blame the tech companies, the algorithms, the platforms. And I'm not suggesting that they aren't to blame, because I think they've done a good job of exploiting the technology. But I think the real source of the problem lies in the fact that human beings were very social, but we've evolved to socialize and to develop relations in a physical world where there are limits to the number of people you interact with. And if you think back to 2008, when people went online, they went online through laptops and desktops. The iPhone had just come out literally a couple of months before. Nobody was quite sure what to make of this little thing. You know, social media apps and other apps didn't exist. And social media itself was kind of something kids did in the main view, and kind of silly. So at a technological level, kind of everything has changed. And we think getting access to unlimited amounts of information will make us smarter, because information is kind of the raw material thought. But actually, when it comes at us in such volume, it's constantly interrupting our train of thought, constantly distracting us. And so instead of making us deeper thinkers, it ends up making us shallower thinkers. And I think something similar, we see something similar when we now look at the social effects of social media and the internet. We assume that more communication with other people will mean more understanding of other people. But again, there's this effect that when you're overwhelmed with communication, when you communicate too much, you become much more impulsive, much more judgmental. You have to rush to conclusions. You have hot takes, not only about the news and information, but about other people. And it actually triggers a lot of our worst social qualities rather than our better ones.
Nick, this is like you're touching on one of my all-time favorite dinner party conversations, which is I'm convinced that we were not built for this. We were not built for this kind of information life, really. Let's kind of go back and talk a little bit about how we even got here. When social media sites were first created and being developed and gaining popularity, what was the promise? Like, what was the sell? What did people think or hope social media would bring them?
So, you know, if you think way back to social media in its early stages, people chose what they looked at. You know, your friends had their own profile pages, and you'd open up your laptop or whatever, and you'd go to your profile page, see what people had written, then you'd go to other people's profile pages.
I think a lot of people might have forgotten that is how they initially use these things, right? Like, oh, let me go see what my friends
right.
are up to.
And the important thing there is you were making the choice of what you looked at.
Right.
And because everybody was in control of what was posted and in control of what they saw, in some ways it was kind of a fun extension of normal sociality. Mm. And it was only when it turned into something much, much more, because naturally the companies who were operating these things wanted to maximize their profits and saw that they could actually not just be a platform for banter among friends and would-be romantic partners and stuff, but could actually become the main way people exchange information, the main source of news, the main source of pretty much any informational aspect of life, that things changed and changed in a kind of fundamental way.
Mm. And you talk about some of the early changes. For example, you talk about Facebook's newsfeed in 2006 being a new way of presenting information to people. In 2009, the like button on Facebook and the retweet button on Twitter also changed how people could interact on those platforms. Can you talk about those changes and what the implications were?
One thing that happens when society moves onto a computer network that is run by network engineers and software programmers is that there's this drive to make aspects of human socializing more efficient. That's what programmers do. That's what network engineers do. They make things more efficient. So in some ways, if you look through the history of social media, it's all about finding some aspect of how we interact with each other that is kind of slow or has friction, as engineers like to say, in making it faster and removing the friction. So if you think about when Facebook introduced the newsfeed and you look at what Mark Zuckerberg and other Facebook executives said at the time, they were frustrated by the fact that people moved between different profile pages and gathered information slowly. This was suboptimal from their point of view. You wanted everything to go as fast and be as efficient as possible. So they introduced the newsfeed, which means that instead of people kind of going from one place to another in whatever haphazard way they might naturally do, suddenly you had the machine, the computers, pumping information to you all the time. Mm. And something similar happens with the like button and with the retweet button. If you think back before Twitter introduced the retweet button, people were retweeting other people's tweets, but it was a manual process.
Yes, right.
You would type capital RT to indicate it was a retweet. Then you would put the person whose tweet you were retweeting's Twitter handle there, and then you would actually cut and paste
yes,
the tweet into there.
That's right. You're reminding me of this. Yeah, the users came up with that way of,
right,
of doing it.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, in their wisdom, the owners of Twitter said, oh, let's speed that up. Mm-hmm. Let's just turn it into a single button, which from their mindset, and even from a lot of the user mindset, you know, made sense. Oh, it's quicker. But what we discover is that friction and slowness is where human judgment and human interpretation comes into the process. So just the act of actually taking a few seconds to cut and paste things gave you a moment to think about, you know, do I really want to spread this? Should I think more about it? Should I actually go and read the article that's being highlighted rather than just assume that I'm going to go ahead and retweet it? You take out that little bit of time and you think, oh, that's going to make everything more efficient and better. And it actually removes a lot of human judgment and a lot of the kind of nuance of how we make sense of the world, how we make sense of one another. And the like button did something very similar. Now you wouldn't have to write back to a person who posted a photograph that you thought was adorable and say, oh, thanks for sending that along. And kind of explain why you liked it. You can just hit the little heart and
right,
you're done.
Shortcut, yeah.
And I think the history of social media has in some ways been this application of this kind of industrial ethos of efficiency and productivity onto these very intimate human processes that actually do not work all that well when you remove the friction and you speed them up as much as you can.
It feels undeniable now that TikTok has really significantly changed social media. I think a lot of people still think of it as something fairly new. It has been around since 2016. How do you see TikTok influencing the entire landscape?
Yeah. So in some ways, TikTok kind of pushed social media to its logical conclusion. In that, as soon as Facebook introduced the newsfeed and made it algorithmic, suddenly the machine, the algorithm, was choosing what you looked at. And what all the social media platforms quickly realized is that the algorithms, because they tracked what grabbed your attention in the past, were very good at feeding you information that grabbed your attention moment by moment. And so they all moved to that. In TikTok, in some ways, just pushed it as far as I can imagine it going, though somebody might figure out how to push it further, which is kind of ignoring the whole idea of, oh, this is about connecting with friends and family, and just saying, look, we can create an algorithm that is going to put this little compelling video in front of you, and based on how you react, we're going to be able to give this unending stream of these little extremely enticing videos geared to just you. And, you know, TikTok is built around the For You page. And they figured out, regardless of the content or the meaning of anything, they can just show you what they know is going to grab your attention. And that also, of course, creates huge incentives for the people creating TikTok videos to craft those videos also in a way that is going to grab your momentary attention. So it kind of pushed things to, in some ways, a logical progression, but to an extreme. And then, of course, all the other platforms, whether it's X or Facebook or whatever, kind of adopted that same attitude as well as technology toward the viewer or listener.
It's funny, you know, in this search for endless optimization, I'm remembering something that you wrote about in that 2008 Atlantic article, actually, the core of it, right, talking about Google being on this relentless pursuit of optimizing the algorithm, right, and trying to figure out how to really study people's behaviors and deliver the best possible search results. And it's funny because I think about this a lot. Google today feels almost unusable to me. When I Google something, the results that I see are not particularly helpful, don't normally lead me to the right answer. I feel like I have to do a lot of scrolling to find things. I don't know what else to say about that. I'm curious to know what your thoughts are. I feel like our race to optimize is making us less efficient, actually.
Right. Google, in the beginning, it came out of a graduate school program, right? Search results were modeled on how you judge academic articles through citations and citation analysis. And so it was a sincere attempt, and a very good one, very successful one, to actually figure out a way to look at all the information that was available online, and there was already a ton, and figure out what really is the best source of information about whatever topic a person was searching for. And that, for the first few years of Google, that really defined the company and its search engine. And it was remarkable if you were using it and you were used to earlier search engines, which were kind of chaotic and horrible. And suddenly it really did feel like you had this great archivist at your beck and call and who was going to deliver this useful piece of information. But, you know, Google had to make money. It lost a lot of money in those early years. And of course, the only way it really could make money was through advertising. But what happened then is Google went from this kind of academic operation to a media organization. And search results turned into content. You wanted to feed people search results that actually grab their attention in the way that social media companies do. And I think if you compare Google today with what it was back in, you know, 2000 when it was just starting out, it's almost a parody. and everything that I think the founders feared would happen when they began to make money with advertising and therefore had to be in the business of supplying content rather than supplying knowledge has come to pass. Mm. And so like you, I go to Google today and it's just this, it's bizarre. It's just this mishmash of all sorts of information, most of it coming from Google itself now. And, you scroll down far enough, maybe you'll find actually a thoughtful article or two.
Yeah, totally.
And to jump ahead, now, of course, the first thing you see is an AI-generated summary.
Yes.
And so instead of getting, you know, the real thoughtful thing that you might have been looking for and that might have expanded your knowledge, you get this banal summary that's drawn often from Wikipedia or other sites that are themselves summaries. So.
And I'll admit, I always read the AI summary now, partly because I'm curious to know how the AI is summarizing what it's seeing.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah.
I mean, it is interesting because at least Google shows you kind of the source documents for the AI summary. But you realize when you look at that, that these sources are kind of, as I said, the sources are themselves summaries. So it's summarizing summaries. And the true, you know, knowledgeable articles by people who know something about it just get pushed ever, ever further into the background.
We're getting farther and farther away from it. It's funny when you said that Google has sort of become a parody of its early self. Isn't that true, though, of almost all of the social media platforms, too, right? I mean, they all started as some dinky thing, little idea. And look at them now. I mean, some of them are still under the leadership of their original creators, a few of them, not many.
Yeah.
But now we're looking at really just a few very powerful CEOs of these big companies. Tell me a little bit about how you see this stage of the evolution of social media.
You know, one of the fundamental early promises of the internet and certainly of social media was that it would be a force for democratization. The idea was you had all these gatekeepers for information and culture, publishers, TV networks, magazines, newspapers, and so on. And they were keeping us all, you know, locked into this very small amount of information that they controlled. And we'd get rid of that. And suddenly, people would be free to pick and choose what information they looked at and to construct knowledge out of this. And so it would tear down these walls and democratize media and knowledge and everything. And I think what we've actually seen is that we have even more powerful gatekeepers now. Mm. We have these kind of empires of information in the form of Meta and Google and X, who control, you know, not just, it's not like a newspaper that had controlled, you know, a certain amount of news stories or a radio program that had its own limited amount of information or a TV network. They control information in all forms, you know, everything from people's intimate conversations to how information about big, important political and social issues is circulated. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing what is always a very dangerous possibility when it comes to media, which is that media comes under the control of powerful individuals, often, or corporations, who now, instead of, you know, seeing it as a way to make money, they begin to see it as a way to gain power. And I think we see this with Elon Musk, for instance, with the purchase of Twitter and renaming it X. Everybody said, oh, what a stupid business idea. And it certainly looked kind of stupid in the beginning. But if you want to gain power, political power and other sorts of power, in addition to economic power, you know, what oligarchs and authoritarians and totalitarians always do is take hold of media. Mm. And I don't want to exaggerate what may be going on here, but we certainly see signs of that, where control over media systems that are actually more expansive than any media systems we've seen in the past are coming under the control of individuals or small groups of people who have a political agenda they want to push forward. So it's beyond making, you know, billions of dollars.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, let's stay with Elon Musk for a moment, because I think this is a really good example. How have you seen the app change under his leadership? He bought it in 2022, of course, changed the name from Twitter to X, as you said. What do you see as his impact so far?
Well, I was never a huge fan of Twitter, I have to say, because I think it was very argumentative. It was very, I think it kind of, even though you had very smart people on it and all the journalists and stuff, it kind of devolved into bickering and wasn't very enlightening. I think what we've seen, for one thing, the most obvious thing is a dramatic shift from the political left to the political right. Twitter tended to skew left until Musk took it over and made a point of promoting himself and his own views, which at the time were also drifting to the right. So the kind of politics of the platform has changed kind of dramatically. You know, we talked about things becoming parodies of themselves. It is kind of also become a parody of itself, where it's all kind of people just yelling and yelling at other people who agree with them, and then patting each other on the back for, you know, saying something even more extreme than anybody had said it before. In some ways, I think all social media platforms are fated to move in this direction. To me, it just feels, I don't know, repellent. and not for the politics of it, but for the way things are expressed on it.
Yeah. Well, there's tone and tenor, which is definitely one aspect of it. There's also content, which, as we've seen, I mean, when Musk took over Twitter and renamed it, he did take away some of the guardrails around the type of speech. Some of the guardrails around hate speech were removed, and we saw hate speech proliferate on the platform since then. Now there's a lot of talk from Meta, which owns Facebook, about ending some of its content moderation and fact-checking specifically operations. How do you understand these announcements as you're hearing them?
Well, I tend to disagree with most things Mark Zuckerberg says and does, but I have some sympathy with his decision to end the third-party fact-checking, which is important to say is a small part of the content moderation activity, which is vast. Mm-hmm. And so they're still trying to identify the horrible stuff and get rid of it, hopefully before it even appears. The fact-checking, I don't think ever worked very well. It was often done after the fact. So even when, you know, there was a note appended to something or it was removed, it had already had hours or even days to circulate, and that's an eternity on social media. Mm-hmm. And so I do think the argument that fact-checking as Meta was doing it was more about enforcing orthodoxy than enforcing factual discourse. I have some sympathy for that because mm-hmm. I do think the whole thing was political from the start. The fact that Zuckerberg announced he was getting rid of it right before the inauguration shows you that it was political from the start.
You know, I'm thinking about how for a lot of people, I think the image of seeing a lot of tech CEOs seated very prominently at President Trump's inauguration was sort of a signal. It was a signal about a shift toward conservative ideals among a lot of these organizations and perhaps on the platforms themselves. How do you see this as a potential pivot moment?
The leaders or the founders, the movers and shakers of the business side of the internet have, I think, always from very early on been fundamentally libertarian in their views, which is different from conservative. They very much, you know, don't want oversight. Mm-hmm. In their minds, you know, simply allowing people to do anything they want to do and say anything they want to do fits with their worldview that all systems of authority are their enemies. And then for quite a while, because they fit those libertarian leanings, very strong leanings, into a kind of general social liberalism and kind of align themselves with the Democratic Party and stuff. But I think in the background, there was always a conflict there. And in some ways, because Trump in the second administration has kind of made it acceptable in a way that wasn't true in his first administration, made it acceptable for these kind of extreme libertarian views to come out into the open. That's what we're seeing. And the big tech companies see this in more than political terms, but in terms of money and power.
Yeah, in capitalist terms.
Mm-hmm. In capitalist terms, that here they have a sympathetic administration. Trump was always, for a long time, was gung-ho about banning TikTok. All of a sudden, he's saving it. He's pumping huge amounts of money into AI and removing restrictions on AI. So it's suddenly this very symbiotic relationship that is political, but also economic and financial between government and the big tech companies in what looks very much like an oligarchy emerging in America.
Yeah. I'm thinking about TikTok, all that we've said so far about how influential it's been. And one really remarkable storyline, of course, in the past couple of weeks has been marching toward this TikTok ban. Congress deciding to pass a TikTok ban in the first place, actually, right? And then it going into effect for a number of hours before Trump signed an executive order delaying the enforcement of the ban, saying that he wants to find a way for it to continue under a new buyer. I mean, from a societal standpoint, what are the implications of our government attempting to ban a social media platform that is so widely used?
You know, because it's owned by a Chinese company, TikTok is not a clear-cut case in any way. Mm. Because Congress and politicians in general have for a long time talked about reining in social media, but they've done very, very little. And so in some ways, because TikTok is owned by a Chinese company, it provides a kind of easy target for politicians to attack social media, attack a platform without actually dealing with social media itself. It becomes just, oh, there's foreign ownership of an important source of information. I don't know enough about if or how a platform like an app like TikTok actually can be used for espionage or for spying. I think it's a genuine concern. But I think the thing that we see with social media right now is that in some ways, you know, a lot of people who make a living on TikTok are obviously extremely unhappy. And you can totally understand that. And people for whom TikTok is a centerpiece of the entertainment in their lives, you can also see why they'd be angry. But in some ways, I think the outrage has been quite limited because I think people know that social media now, it's not about any one platform. If you ban TikTok, it's actually not going to change social media itself. Social media is already adapted to TikTok. You'll get replacement TikToks. So in some ways, it is this kind of big show that may, whether it's banned or not, may have no effect on how social media operates if you jump ahead 5 years and look back on it. Because, you know, social media is kind of this, I don't know what you call it, but it's able to kind of reshape itself to fill in any gaps that might emerge, whether it's simply a new opportunity to provide some kind of new information flow, or it's you remove a platform and the others just fill in the gaps.
Right. It grows new heads all the time, is sort of what you're saying.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. So I guess the big question is, I mean, where does it all go from here, right? We are now clearly more aware of what social media is doing to all of us, what technology is doing to us, how we're interacting with it. What comes next?
We're certainly more aware of the problems and more skeptical of the technology, but there's not really any sign that our behavior has changed. Mm-hmm. We still like it, and we still use it, even as we complain about it. So I say this with considerable sorrow, but I do have a pessimistic view because I think we have kind of adapted to the system, even though it might not be in our best interest, and even though in some cases it makes us unhappy and anxious and whatever, we nevertheless have reshaped our lives and our attitudes around the network. And because we tend to say, oh, we can fix social media or we can fix the internet by tweaking the algorithms or by banning TikTok or by breaking up Meta, I actually don't think that is going to work, because I would argue that the system is not broken. The system is operating exactly as it is meant to operate. So I don't think we can tweak our way out of this. To me, if things are going to change, it's going to be because of the dominance of the technology over people's lives and now increasingly over government and politics. When you get that kind of dominance of some force in society, you often call forth a counterculture. Hmm. And to me, if there's going to be a real change in the future, it's going to be because some new generation of young people, and that's where countercultures always come from, are going to come of age and they're going to say, we don't want any part of this. This is for adults, and it's how adults have screwed everything up. Hmm. We don't want your phone. We don't want your social media.
Ugh, my mom's on TikTok. Yeah, why would right. I want to be on TikTok?
And so it seems to me that that's possible. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I really wouldn't be surprised because it is so dominant now. But I might just be a fantasist and a romantic who thinks it's going to come along. But otherwise, I think the system is here to stay, which doesn't mean that individuals don't have agency. And maybe as individuals, we can say, like any tool, it has its uses, but maybe there are other tools when we want to converse with each other or correspond with each other. So yeah, in the big picture, I don't see an easy solution, but I will emphasize that that doesn't mean that people themselves can't change how they behave.
Yeah, yeah. Are there ways in which you have intentionally tried to bring friction back into your life that maybe technology has had begun to flatten out for you?
One thing I do is if there is something I want to read that is substantial, an article, an essay, certainly a book, I don't read it online. I make the effort, whether it's buying it or going to a library to get it, or if it's an article printing out of my printer, to actually sit down and read it. Because I do think that a printed page in some ways provides a barrier against distraction. So I think imposing on yourself ways to actually screen out distractions, actually focus, whether it's on a written work or a conversation or anything, that may well be seen as a source of friction, because for the people supplying information in such huge quantities, it means you're slowing down and you're not juggling lots of things simultaneously. Mm. But I do think that's kind of the only way to unlock some of our highest human abilities to think and to perceive and to understand one another.
Mm. Lean into the ways that your brain works that are supposed to be good for it instead of the ways that it works in bad ways.
Right, which are often slow in an industrial sense, sub-optimized, and that's a good thing.
Yeah. Nick, thank you. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You can find Nicholas Carr's book, Superbloom: How Technologies of Connection Tear Us Apart, on Apple Books. We'll include a link for you on our show notes page.